Right now, we're in the middle of the 18-day EML program, and Venerable Chodron is teaching each day, and so she's suggested that we come together and do some review, just the community, do some review of debate, what she's taught in the last few weeks. So that's what we'll do tonight. So let's begin by cultivating a motivation for our time together. Venerable Chodron has given some excellent teachings the last 9-10 days, and she reminded us that as impermanent phenomena, we are conditioned by countless external and internal factors. And since that's the case, it's important to think of ourselves as conditioned beings and to look at what our conditioning has been to date so that we can consciously determine how we want to be conditioned in the future. And so she outlined how there are many kinds of conditioning that we've received from family, from society, from media, layers of conditioning that attempt to tell us who we are and what our true worth and value are. And so she challenged us to really look to see how aware are we of this conditioning. So each of us has been conditioned through racial and ethnic identities that we hold, regional identities, identities around gender and sexual orientation, class and age identities, educational and occupational identities, political and religious identities, etc. We also have identities around things that have happened to us as children, as teenagers, as young adults. And so she advised that as we become aware of our conditioning, then we can diminish its strength, the strength of these fixed identities, this grasping to a sense of I. And through our practices, we begin to update the old habitual conditioning and identities and eventually let them go. So each of us can attest that that takes a lot of effort on our part to stay mindful of our values, our principles, the kind of person we actually want to be. And so we must constantly steer our mind in a positive direction to avoid replaying old patterns and behaviors and old strategies that we've internalized. And so as we've seen, observing our thoughts and checking to see if our thinking produces a correct syllogism can be a very valuable tool to use in our healing work, in our spiritual work, our spiritual growth. So tonight, let's continue listening and reflecting, debating and meditating on collected topics and reasoning and debate so that we can actually progress towards greater valid awarenesses and towards complete freedom. And not only for ourselves, but for the benefit of all living beings. In looking at some of the teachings that Venerable Chodron has done in the last year on this topic, I notice that she often starts by sort of warming us up, in a sense, getting us to look at ourselves, look at different things. And so I sent out an email suggesting that we could start with some syllogisms, if anybody brought any. So let's start there. Did anybody have time to come up with one or two?
My parents' generation is the greatest generation. They have this saying. My reason. Because they were victorious in World War II. They have a different reason. But it's just been something that's playing in my head. So there's this belief.
Uh-huh. So my
that isn't the reason, though, that they give. My parents' generation was the greatest generation because they were the pinnacle of this country's existence.
The pinnacle, what does that mean?
They have the belief that the best time of this country that ever has existed
was their
making. My syllogism is because of there was no competition after World War II.
Your consequence to them.
But yeah. So
okay, so what's the
syllogism? Is their syllogism that I understand it is my parents' generation is the greatest generation this country has ever seen because they were the cause of the most of the pinnacle of the United States of America.
Okay. So let's check that. Is the property of the subject established? My parents' generation is the pinnacle.
It's the pinnacle of this, of the United States of America.
Is that true? Probably every generation thinks they're the pinnacle, and I think especially those who were came of age in the 60s would really argue.
Yeah, and it also depends on how you're defining it, what that means to you, if it means material success or there's a lot of
very subjective, isn't it? Okay, good. Thank you for that.
Consider the subject Chuni. She is responsible for the behavior of her peers and juniors because she was the firstborn child.
Okay, is the reason established?
Yes.
Venerable Chuni was the firstborn child.
Okay. And if you're the firstborn child,
are you necessarily responsible for the behavior of your peers and juniors?
Oh, I was a firstborn child. Sometimes my mind is very stuck, and then I say to myself when I'm a jumper, the subject is a very difficult student because she has many afflictions.
Okay, let's check that.
A jumper has many afflictions, yes. If somebody has many afflictions, is necessarily a difficult student? No, not necessarily.
Anybody here not have many afflictions? Well, I'll put my hand down. I have many afflictions. You're in good company, so we can normalize that a bit.
Cultural identity, right? So I have a poor character because I write Chinese characters untidily. That's what I grew up with, yeah. Like, people with bad Chinese handwriting have lousy character. You better not be one of those.
Okay. Okay, let's check it.
I write Chinese characters untidily, yes.
Okay, the reason is established.
Yeah. But just because you write Chinese characters untidily, well, no, it does mean you're sloppy because you're not mindful as you write those lines. No, that's the reasoning I'm saying, you know, that my mother would say. Mm-hmm. If you were mindful and had good character, you would be neat.
No pervasion.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Thank you.
One who is born will die because the body is impermanent.
Okay. One who is born will die. Because the body is impermanent. So let's check that. Is the property of the subject established? One who is born and the body is impermanent. So we're talking about, there's a little bit of, what would you say, the subject and the reason don't match up quite neatly because we're talking about a person in the first instance. The subject is a person, one who is born. And then the reason was, because the body is impermanent. Maybe we could say because the person is impermanent. Okay. So let's try that. One who is born in a body will die because the body is impermanent. So one who is born in a body, you don't think it works?
Yeah, I think there's a flaw in my logic. In here, so I can't make a correct one somehow.
Well, some of the pieces you have are actually correct. Impermanent beings that have causes and conditions, will disintegrate. That's the definition of composed phenomena, disintegrated phenomena. So we just have to tweak it a little bit to get the subject predicate and reason matching up. Can anybody help her? You're trying to prove that the person will die, right? One who is born will die.
And that... that's a result of impermanence, but I'm not sure that they die because of impermanence. You see what I'm saying?
Yep. Formless realm beings also are subject to disintegration, let's say. The mind doesn't leave the body, as in death. That's usually how death is explained.
So all samsaric bodies disintegrate. Mm-hmm. So all samsaric bodies disintegrate. So, mm-hmm. It is true. Mm-hmm.
Well, formless beings don't have bodies, so their body...
They don't have a body that is impermanent because they don't have bodies. So
okay, good. Yeah, it works. All right. Good job for your first syllogism. Thank you.
I'm not worthy of compassion because I make a lot of mistakes.
Ouch. Okay, let's check that. I am not worthy of compassion because I make a lot of mistakes. Is the subject established? Is the reason established, I mean? The property of the subject? What would be the property of the subject? Let's start there. Do you make a lot of mistakes? No, we all make a lot of mistakes. Okay, all right, so we can own that, right? In fact, that's part of our practice as monastic, is to own our mistakes. Say, I made a mistake, I own this mistake, and we try to do better. So that's okay. And if you make a mistake, it means you're not worthy of compassion. Is that true? Oh, some part of you. Why? Yeah.
Because you hurt yourself and others if you make mistakes.
It's true, but does that mean that you're not worthy of someone wishing you to be free of your suffering? Aren't you even more of an object of compassion if you're holding that view?
Yeah, that'd be nice to think that way.
I would think so. How would that look?
Venerable Chuni is worthy of compassion because she makes a lot of mistakes. That's better.
Did you say is worthy or is not worthy? You said is.
Oh. Is not worthy.
Is not worthy of compassion. Okay. Venerable Chuni is not worthy of compassion because she makes a lot of mistakes. Is that true for you?
It just seems that way.
Is that true for you, Venerable Chuni?
No. Okay. Not for other people.
I see. So selective reasoning. Mm-hmm. All right. So I think the reasoning has shown that that's an erroneous conception. That's a wrong view, wrong consciousness. Mm-hmm. And you might have to go through it a few times and really check, how does this land? Is this true? And challenge it and then try it on other people. If it's, you know, all beings are worthy of compassion, right? That's it, kind of innate or inherent. I hate to use the word inherent, but it comes along with the definition of compassion. All beings are worthy of compassion from a Buddhist point of view. So thank you for challenging that thought in your mind. And we as a community can help support something different, a different thought. You are worthy of compassion because you're you.
Well, it also implies that I have to curtail my compassion selectively.
Anyone who makes mistakes, we can't have compassion
for them.
Yeah, it kind of defeats. Then we couldn't develop bodhicitta. That would be a problem.
It seems like becoming aware of someone's suffering and the mistakes are oftentimes when we see someone making mistakes, we become aware that there's suffering behind that. Seeing someone suffering is what inspires compassion in those who are cultivating compassion. So if someone has no suffering, that would be someone who is not an object of compassion. Because if someone had no suffering, then that would be someone who's not an object of compassion, because how can you wish them to be free of their suffering?
Okay. We have to be careful with that, because arhats don't have suffering and they're still objects of compassion of bodhisattvas and Buddhas, aren't they? But I get your point. Those who are free of obscurations, let's say. Because there's still a kind of, you know, we can call their situation a kind of suffering. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I think all sentient beings are worthy of compassion because they're controlled by karma and affliction and suffer. Now, I think that's a valid syllogism.
So the subject, Nima, is self-centered because she talks a lot about herself.
Okay, let's check it. The subject, Venerable Nima.
The subject, Nima talks a lot about herself. That would be the property of the subject.
Okay, let's take a vote. How many think that Venerable Nima talks too much about herself? Well, talks a lot about herself. Talks about herself at all. Maybe in your head, but not out loud. Yeah.
A mental factor.
Okay.
That the Buddhas have compassion because they have cultivated bodhicitta. So
Wait, that's a syllogism right there. The Buddhas have cultivated compassion.
Yeah, so if you have cultivated bodhicitta, you necessarily have compassion that includes you have all sentient beings in your purview.
Yes, but I think the syllogism would be Buddhas, all Buddhas have bodhicitta because they've developed compassion for all sentient beings. The compassion is the cause of the bodhicitta, not the other way around. But yes, but that's true. Thank you. Okay, so especially when we think about identities, this is where I get tripped up a lot, is clinging to identities, and then I have all these erroneous ideas. I have this identity, therefore I won't reveal my many personalities, my many identities. But, my largest identity that trips me up is I have some knowledge, you know, and because I've studied. And that leads to a lot of arrogance. So it's not a correct syllogism, is it?
Was that a syllogism?
Well, it could be. Let's see. What did I say?
I have knowledge because I've studied.
I have.
Are you better than other people because you've studied?
Yeah, that's where the identity, the arrogance comes in. Yeah, so Venerable was talking about really identifying these different kinds of identities that we hold on to, whether it's our occupation or our education or our sexual orientation, our race, our age. I'm superior to others because I'm young, or whatever the case may be. So I think it's worthwhile to apply these syllogisms that we've been practicing. To try to debunk a lot of our erroneous ways of thinking, and we'll have less suffering if we do that. So that's why I wanted to bring in her teachings from earlier this week. You know, it's so easy to listen to teaching after teaching after teaching, make beautiful notes, put it in the computer, close the lid. So I'm really trying to make an effort this time to take on board these beautiful teachings from EML. Okay, let's go back to our text. And we can do that by starting with some debate, just to create some context. Venerable Dunya was, when he was here, he was debating with a lot of us, and he was, or some of us, and he was showing us how to start a debate. You kind of just create some general context to get you to the topic that you're going to be debating more specifically. So in our Buddhist ontology, we can start by just making some statements, and you can either say I accept or why. So the selfless is divided into existence and non-existence. The definition of existence is that which is observed by a reliable cognizer. Existence are divided into functioning things and phenomena that are non-things. It's one of the seven ways. It's one of the seven ways that existence can be divided. And functioning thing, for whatever reason, is the main way that they talk about it in collected topics. Okay, so you accept? Okay, good. Functioning things can be divided into three divisions. Posit those divisions. Matter, consciousness, and abstract composites. Okay. So how do these two compare? Functioning thing and matter. Three possibilities. Right. Anything that is a subset or an instance of a larger category, a larger group, is automatically three possibilities, either with or without something that is neither. And I wonder if it seems to make sense to me if we just say, if there is something that is neither, that's the more common experience when something is a subset. There will be 3P with something that is neither. You can find an example of something that is neither. The only time, or in those few instances when you can't find something which is neither, is usually when selfless is one of the categories. And so there's nothing outside of that. Or there are other variations, as Venerable Losang posited a really good debate when we were out working on trees the other day. And it also had nothing that was neither. So I think if we say 3P, that means there is, we can assume there's something that is neither. But if there's not something that is neither, because we're talking about large categories that exclude everything else, then we'd say 3P with nothing that is neither. All right. How do the two compare? But you have to have more than one instance. Can you say more about that?
You can't have just one instance in a one of those circles. There has to be more than one.
There has to be more than one instance in the circle. So the category has to have more than one instance. Can you think of something that's a category and only has one instance?
I think it doesn't work, actually, then. But so you can't say any instance. I don't know if you can say an instance. Well, there are things that don't have, maybe aren't generalities, like matter itself.
Matter?
Matter itself.
Matter is
a generality, but where's the instance?
Color and shape. The divisions can be considered instances, or we can talk about pots and pillars and cups and strikers and cough drops.
Maybe one that wouldn't have an instance would be the pair.
Okay.
A cup and a gong.
Yeah, the two, pillar and pot, or cup and gong.
Something like that. I know that case comes up.
Yeah. That can be a...
That might have been it.
...category, but is there anything that is the two? No. Okay, let's save that. That's tricky. I'm not prepared to go there.
One thing that would be not a category would be if you were comparing two things and one of them were a specific person, like Venerable Tenzin Sepo. That would not be a category. That would be a...
And there's only one instance of that.
Yeah.
Okay, but there in your... Okay, all right.
Unless you want to say, oh, there's other people with that name, but it wouldn't be what we're talking about.
I tried to get a Gmail account, and all the Tenzin Sepos were already taken. Okay. All right, how do the two compare, matter and consciousness? Mutually exclusive, why is that? That's right, there's no common locus. Yeah, okay. And how do the two compare, matter and abstract composites? Mutually exclusive also. How do these two compare? Matter and non-consciousness. 3P? Okay, well, it's something that's both. Yeah, the matter. Matter, or you could say matter, or you could say something specific like the gong. Okay, something that is matter but not non-consciousness. There isn't anything, is there? So when we're talking about non-consciousness itself, we're covering up, we're excluding consciousness, and it includes everything else. So if we're saying non-consciousness, the only thing that's there is consciousness, right? So something that is matter but not non-consciousness. Not non-consciousness. There isn't anything that's matter that is not non-consciousness. Right, okay, there isn't anything. And what about something that is non-consciousness but not matter? Democracy. Any abstract composite would work. So we're looking for something that is non-consciousness, so we're going to cover up consciousness, and it would include everything else, but it can't be matter. Okay, so we're excluding matter and consciousness. So it could be a permanent phenomena, it could be an abstract composite, could be a non-existent. And what's something that is neither matter or non-consciousness? Consciousness. Very good. Okay, so when we put in the nons, then it really causes you to slow down and think long and hard. In fact, the comparison that Venerable Losong presented was, how did the two compare non-permanent phenomena and non-impermanent phenomena? It was a good mind-bender. And then we went through all the permutations of why each was and was not different things. So maybe we can do that one at the end of the class, if we have time. Okay, so the definition of matter can't be posited. Thank you. The definition of matter can be posited. Posit that definition. Okay, so it follows that the definition of matter is that which is atomically established. You say, I accept. So when we finish up with that last, there's really, each person has four parts there. You say the definition of blank can't be posited. Why? Or, we'll come to that later. So it follows the definition. It follows because now it's a consequence to what that person has just said. They said it. They said, why? That means I don't believe you. So, okay, from what you've said, it follows that it can be posited. You say, I accept. And then we say, posit that. You posit the definition. And then just to complete that round, you say, so it follows that the definition of da-da-da is da-da-da. And they say, I accept. Nice and tidy, isn't it? I was talking with Venerable Pella just before class, and she steered me to a book by Geshe Tarchin that I look forward to reading, and we have a couple of copies in the library. I'm sorry, I didn't hold on to the title just then, but she said he so gently lays out how you describe debating for Westerners. So I'm really looking forward to it. But he says, so this little debate that we just did, and like the debates that are in the debate primer that Venerable Chuni brought back from Dharamsala, there are some very pat, standard formulas for debating definitions, debating divisions, debating examples, debating pervasions. And these are little debates that we just need to go through like 20 or 30 times using different examples of all the things we're memorizing. Well, one good result of that is that we'll memorize definitions easily. And the other reason is that we get very familiar. The other benefit is we get very familiar with that line of reasoning so that it becomes second nature to us because we're learning a new language doing debate. So then once we've established the definition, we move on to the divisions. So when you divide matter, how many divisions are there? Oh, what are those two? Posit those two, please.
Internal and external matter.
Okay, thank you. And when you... okay, so what's the definition of internal matter? External matter cannot be posited. The definition of external matter can be posited. Somebody posit that definition.
The definition of external matter is that which is atomically established and not conjoined with consciousness.
Okay, so it follows that the definition of external matter is that which is atomically established and is not conjoined with consciousness. Not included within the continuum of consciousness. Thank you. Of a person. Okay, thank you. No, good. I'm glad. I didn't include that one in the...
You would say, oh, then the definition is not...
Right. Okay, so let's back up a step. So Venerable Lamsa gave a definition, and it was getting all the... Yeah, it was getting at the meaning, but it wasn't quite precise. So then I would come back and I would say, just a minute, oh, so it follows that the definition of internal matter, external matter, is not that which is atomically established and not included within the continuum of person. You'd have to say, why? And then I'd get to say, tsa, because you've contradicted yourself. Okay. That's how it works, sorry.
Is there's no way that I would say, I accept, or?
Let's see. I just said, so it follows that the definition is not, and then I gave the correct one. So if you say, I accept, you're accepting that that's not the definition. If you're holding to your definition, you'd say, so it's one of those, you're kind of backed into a corner. Yeah. Okay, good. Thank you. Okay, so when we divide external matter, how many divisions are there?
Visual form, auditory form, olfactory form, gustatory form, and tactile form.
Okay, now I haven't seen it written out with form on the end of each of those. All of those are form if you're talking about the larger category of matter or form or external form. Source is the word.
Forms, external form source or external?
So here we're looking source? At external matter.
Yeah.
And there are five divisions.
Yes.
And there's visual form or uh-huh. form source.
Uh-huh.
There's sound or sound source.
Uh-huh.
And the definitions are slightly different. You can see that with sound. With form, it seems like visual form, the form source and visual form has the same definition, an object apprehended by an eye consciousness. But if you look at sound, sound is defined as an object of hearing, where sound source is an object of hearing of an ear consciousness. Mm-hmm. So I think if we add source, remember last week we talked about if something is considered a source, it's a source for a consciousness. It will give rise, it serves as a condition for a new consciousness. So you could say visual source or form source, sound source, smell source, or odor source, taste source, tangible source. You could say it that way.
Just by saying form source, you're implying visual, or do you have to say visual form source? Because they're all form.
They are form, but they are not all form source. So this is why I think Daniel Perdue has matter in the larger category, just to separate the two for us Westerners. Right, so that's one way of doing it. Visual form, a sound, odor, taste, and tangible object, or we could say form source, visible source. No, he uses form source, sound source. Yeah. So, okay, so form source, sound source, odor source, taste source, tangible source. And then in those definitions, you would add this for a certain kind of consciousness because it's linked up. Each of those will have their own unique type of consciousness. Okay, so it follows that the five divisions of matter are visual, forms, sounds, odors, taste, and tangible objects.
I'm just curious if you've seen the term sense, like form, sense, sphere? Like sound,
yes,
sensory. Is that equivalent to source?
Yes. Yeah, it's just a challenge of translation. Well, no, it's not. I don't know. Let's ask. That's your research. You're studying Tibetan.
The literal would be sense sphere.
The literal instead of source? Okay. I wonder if it's the sphere of that particular consciousness. You know, because when we look at what three things come together when we create a new moment of consciousness, there's an object, there's a uncommon empowering condition that only can know a certain type of object, and then there's an immediately preceding condition.
Right.
So the object is what we're looking at here. The visual form or form source is going to be the object for a particular type of consciousness, not all consciousness, just a particular type. So it has an uncommon empowering condition, which is the eye sense power, or eye sense faculty. I think that's why it's described that way. Okay, the definition of visual form can't be posited. Okay, it follows that the definition of visual form can be positive. Okay, posit that definition. So it follows that the definition of visual form is an object apprehended by an eye consciousness. All right, so where do we go from there? If we're just going through normal debating, where would we go from there? Would we go to divisions? That would make the next logical sense, wouldn't it? Okay, so when you divide visual forms, how many divisions are there?
Two.
Those two can't be posited individually. In other words, you can't posit those two. That's what that means. Why? Oh, they can be posited. Please, posit them. Okay, so it follows that color and shape are the two divisions of visual form. Okay, good. Excellent. All right, so I'm really happy that Venerable Chinny brought this debate primer back because we finally have enough knowledge that we can start using these debates. We have finally gotten to colors, and that's where the debating manuals start, with colors. So I hope some of you have this on your devices. And I just want to let people know that this debate primer is free for download. It's the debate primer text one by Sangye Soltram and Tenzin Tarpa, and you can find this online at tibet2009.com. And then you look in the download library, and you'll find it there. And it's a very good practice manual for going through these. It's like learning the alphabet, you know. It's or like learning the multiplication tables. You just have to go through, you know, 2 times 1, 2 times 2, 2 times 3. You have to go through them a lot when you're first learning them so that you understand them, they stick, and then they become part of your debate language. So we can start on page 14, actually. The first debate is called, What is Red? So the challenger says, that part we haven't gotten to in the text. The subject, Justice Manjushri, debated it. We'll come to that, you know, how you start a debate when you stomp your feet and clap your hands. Okay, so then the challenger says, it follows that the subject red is a color. You say, right. The subject red is a color because it's suitable as a hue. Because red's color is suitable as a hue, or red is suitable as a hue. Yeah, I think it's just a different definition of color, suitable to be a hue. You know, I think probably we as Westerners change it because why would you use color in the definition of color? You know, it goes against how we've been trained with definitions. So if you say color, the definition of color is suitable to be a hue, it just lands a little easier for us. If we said the definition of color is that which is suitable to be a color, what does that tell you? The definition of form is that suitable to be form. It's a little problematic. Yeah. Okay. So let's go on. And all right, let's look at page 15. 15 is debating definitions. So I want to point out just a few distinctions between Tibetan language and English language. When I was talking with Venerable Dunyu and several other Tibetan speakers, what they said is that this text has a word-for-word literal translation of the Tibetan so that we can see what that language is like. But it's awkward English when we start looking at it. Okay, so the debate starts with this thesis, there is no definition of color. So the challenger says, because there is nothing posited as color's definition. Now, because it starts with the word because, that's a clue, that's a marker in the Tibetan language that they're positing a reason. And another way of understanding that statement is, I bet you can't posit the definition of color. That's basically what it's saying. Or, as Geshe Tarchin says, it's obvious you can't posit the definition of color. Has a little bit of an edge to it. But basically, it's what we've been saying. The definition of color can't be posited. It's getting at the same thing, isn't it? Okay, and so then the defender, in this text, you'll see, we have been saying, why? Because it doesn't make sense. We know the definition can be posited. But if you look at formal Tibetan debating language, you would say, reason not established. Now, this does the head in because you're thinking, wait, there's a reason, but there's no subject to match it up to say that the reason is not established. So how can you say reason not established? It's a convention. It's how you start a debate. And really what you're meaning here is nonsense. That's not reasonable. That's unreasonable, what you've just said. It doesn't mean reason not established like the subject and the predicate have no, or the subject and the reason have no relationship. It is a reason, but there's no subject. So how can you say reason not established if there's no subject to check the reason against? Is it implied? That's not how it's been explained to me. I could see how it would be. Because, you know, if you say to somebody, because there's nothing posited as color's definition, it does kind of imply the definition of color can't be posited.
Well, especially if that's what the person just said before you.
But they didn't say that before you. Oh, I see. That's how a debate on definitions starts.
Oh, and so the because is implied and they just say...
Well, it's not, the because is not implied. It's actually there in the at the end of the Tibetan. And it's a marker that says this is a reason. So we could even take those brackets out of around because. It actually says because there is nothing posited as color's definition. Okay, so I just wanted to point that out because if you start reading these debates, you'll go, what's going on here? Why is there no reason established? So I've talked with just a few people about this. Just keep that in the back of your mind. Right now for us, getting started with debate, it probably doesn't make any difference if we just say why. But down the track, you know, if we start debating, if we start going to formal debates with other nunneries or monasteries, well, maybe then it's going to matter. So just keep that in the back of the mind, okay? When we get really good at this. Okay, so this defender says, nonsense, no, that's not reasonable. Or why? What?
Say what?
Say what? What are you on about? So then the challenger comes back and says, it follows that there is something posited as color's definition. It follows you can posit a definition for color. I accept. Posit it. And the subject, that which is suitable to be a color. So remember when we first started debating, we were trying to be very formal and we would say the subject and then we'd give the answer. It's up to you. It's very precise language, but also after you've debated a while, I think most people drop that formality. So the subject, that which is suitable to be a color, it follows that the subject, that which is suitable to be a color, is color's definition. I accept. That's pretty straightforward. We've been doing that, actually. We've been doing that. We're familiar with that. But here we are. Remember what I read last week from the debate book where, Geshe Rabten from Switzerland. I read a quote from his that said, debating colors doesn't teach you any content, any new content. It's just getting used to, it's like going through the times table. Okay, so we're going to be debating colors. Yeah.
It's a supposition. It's not based on any knowledge. But in the little class that I did, the review class that was done before Kelsang Wangmo's class, we always were formal with the language about the subject, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And when you start looking at the Pramanavartika and the subjects are this long, I wonder if being able to identify the subject so that you have accurately, you know, named what that subject is, doesn't become kind of important.
Yeah, I take your point, and I agree. I think maybe we've just gotten a little sloppy here in not saying subject. And now that I'm recalling, when I think back, how we translated this when we debated it, or we didn't really, well, okay, we did a little debate at Chenrezig. We would say, take da-da-da,
yeah.
Which implies take the subject. You know, consider this subject, as Dan Perdue says. So let's, for all intents and purposes, let's bring that back in. When we answer, we'll say the subject, da-da-da. Okay?
In the Tibetan, the word for subject is definitely included again and again because actually it comes at the end of, you have those lines, and it has chijin at the end, and that's like, okay, so all before that, you know it's a subject, so it's quite important that you keep it there because it's the mark of where the subject stops.
Good. Thank you for that.
They do. They.
All right, so that's the debating definitions. Then on page 16, we have debating divisions. So when color is divided, how many divisions are there? Actually, in our text, it says color divided. How many divisions are there? Or when you divide color, how many divisions are there? That's another way of translating it. So we say there are two. Color has two main divisions, doesn't it? These two can't be posited individually. That's where I got that wording. It's just a way to get you to state the two divisions. That's all. You say, okay, here's another place. The reason is not established. I find this difficult. I think it's another place where we're just saying nonsense. We're not saying the subject and the reason are not in alignment or not found in each other. Okay, so the reason is not established. So if we say why, that's fine. That it leads to the next step. It means I don't believe you, which is another way of saying nonsense. But if we would translate this back into Tibetan, then we would lose something. So we might need to get some advice. And in fact, Venerable Pala was suggesting that we look towards, well, Venerable Dunya has offered to help us, but also there's a Geshe named Geshe Graham Woodhouse who has done some online classes. So perhaps we can ask some of these questions to him and find a resource that we can use. Or maybe Geshe Dottel when he's here.
So here in this one, those two can't be posited individually, and then the reason is not established. Those two is a subject. Can't be posited is a predicate. And there is no reason. So that's why it says the reason is not established.
But you see,
it's simply lacking a reason.
But when you only have a subject and a predicate, reason not established is typically not a response you give. You have two choices. Why or I accept. So that's why it's odd that it's there. But as Venerable Dunya explained, this is just a debating convention. Uh-huh. So it is a reason because these two can't be posited individually. Okay. That makes sense. So because someone has given a reason and there's no way to establish that reason, you can say nonsense. Well, it's a marker that indicates a reason is following. Yeah. In a syllogism. Would they've given a reason, but if there's no subject, I mean, like Venerable Tarpa said, you could assume that the subject is implied. But I asked about that, and that's I think it was Venerable Donyu who said, that's not really what's being gotten at here. It's that you've been given a reason, you have no subject, no predicate, so, and it's preposterous, because there is a definition for, or there's a division of color. Color can be divided, and those divisions can be posited individually. Okay. So then it follows that those two can be posited individually. I accept. Posit them. Okay, so how is color divided? Very good. It follows that the subject, primary colors and secondary colors are colors divisions. Okay, now I just have a wondering, like if she says, Venerable Jigme just posited the subjects, primary colors and secondary colors, is there any difference if I say it follows that the divisions of color are primary colors and secondary colors? In the text, it says it follows that the subject, primary colors and secondary colors, are colors. It follows, the divisions of colors are colors divisions. Sorry, I didn't see the in. It was in parentheses. It follows that the divisions of color are primary color and secondary color. I think it's six of one, half a dozen of another. I think either way, you're saying these two divisions are colors, or colors divisions are these two. I think it gets at the same thing. Okay, someone can correct me if that's not right. Okay, so again, we're very simple, straightforward, actually. If you want to just look at the one online and write out in your own words so that it flows a little more easily, I think that's a great idea. You can use the language that we've been using. Instead of reason not established, you can just say why. It's up to you. Either one's going to work. And language that you can hang on to and remember, and then just keep going with different definitions, different divisions. So we could take the first one, primary color or root color. When primary color is divided, how many divisions are there? Four. These four can't be posited individually. Why? It follows that these four can be posited individually. Except. Posit them. Blue, yellow, white, and red. It follows that the primary colors are blue, yellow, white, and red. It really helps if you memorize them in the order that they're in the text. And of course, different texts have them in different orders. So pick a text and memorize that order. It will help you remember. If you know there's a list of four or a list of six and you just randomly memorize them, it'll be difficult to call them up. But if you can see something in your mind like BYRW, whatever mnemonic you use, then that's going to be helpful.
I just know there's three root colors, the three primary colors in our system, white is added.
Okay, so how you remember it is by thinking of the three primary colors that we know about in our modern system, and then you add white to that. Okay. But if we looked at the text, I'm pretty sure it's blue, yellow, white, red. Okay. All right, good. So it follows that the subject, blue, yellow, white, red, are the divisions of root colors. So the subject and then, yeah. Okay. Now on page 17, now we're going to debate examples. Okay, so debating examples. There is nothing posited as an example of a root color. Why? Or reason not established. Here's another time where that happens. It follows that there is something that can be posited as an example of a root or primary color. Posit that example. The subject yellow's color. It follows that the subject yellow's color is an example of a root color, a primary color. So there will be things that we're debating that it's important to solicit an example. Someone's maybe given an answer and we want to make sure that they are really, they know what they're talking about. So we say, so posit an example of that. All right, look at debate 5 on page 19. Okay, so now we're going to go off into a little bit of more complexity. Are all colors white? This is what we're going to test here. So the challenger says, if it's a color, it's pervaded by being white. Why? You don't believe me? If it's a color, it's pervaded by... Oh, you said that. It follows that if it's a color, it's not pervaded by being white. I said, posit that. So when we say posit that, it means, can you give me an example? Or please give me an example. Okay, so what's an example? Something that's a color that's not pervaded by being white.
Well, there is an example, the subject red.
Right. So it follows the subject red is pervaded by being a color.
I accept.
The subject red is pervaded by being a color because?
Subject red is pervaded by being a color because the red's color is suitable to be a hue.
Yeah. The subject red is pervaded by being a color because red's color is suitable to be a hue. I think you could just say red, too. Maybe red is... when we looked at definitions of specific colors, we said that which is suitable as a yellow hue. So we could say because red is suitable to be a red hue. Yeah. You have a problem with that?
Kind of.
Okay. Let's hear it.
I've seen this same debate somewhere, and they not only establish that red is a color, they then go ahead and establish that red is not white. Because it's saying that all colors are pervaded by being white. then they go to establish
but
that
we said,
if it's red, it's not white.
Okay.
Which is just long, and but it
so
seems
we said,
like...
We started out, if it's a color, it's pervaded by being white. Why? It follows that if it's a color, it's not pervaded by being white. I accept. Give an example, the subject red. It follows that the subject red is pervaded by being a color. Except the subject red is pervaded by being a color because, okay, it follows the subject red is not white because, is that what you were saying?
Yeah, you have to prove that white is not pervaded by being red.
That's a good point.
That's what you're trying to prove.
Yeah, that's what you're trying to prove. I'm glad you pointed that out. Okay. Well, I think that's covered here. So he's pointing out that the question is, are all colors white? And we've already said in the second sentence, it follows that if it's a color, it's not pervaded by being white. So we've already countered that assertion there in that second line. And so then we say, give an example. And when you gave an example, red, it is a color. It's not white. It's a color because, and then they ask, it's a color. So you're saying, why don't they ask, it's not, why is it not white? Is that what you're saying? Because that's what you're trying to prove.
I've seen this debate somewhere that's similar to this, but they do. They go ahead and they say it follows that if it's red, then it cannot be white. And I don't know.
Well, there is a very...
It seems obvious, but... Yeah.
There's a very long debate about, you know, when the challenger says if it's a color, it's necessarily white. Is that how it goes? I don't know. I haven't... If it's a color, it's necessarily red. And then take is red. And it goes from there. Yeah, so I suspect it's found in that.
That's probably what I saw.
Yeah. We'll get to that. That's a little more complex yet. We're just learning the basics, ABC. I know it's hard to be patient, isn't it? I'm not putting that on you. But I mean, for myself, this is sort of rudimentary, isn't it? But these are the building blocks that we need. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
It's all language.
Yeah.
It's an effect. It isn't about the colors at all.
Right. It's not about the colors. It's about the new language that we're learning. Yeah, and the new way of thinking. That's a good way of putting it. Yeah, we're learning to think logically.
That's really the form of the language. But actually, it's how they think that I find most important.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But, you know, there's a lot of repetition, and we're not used to a lot of repetition in our, well, I don't know. Are we? I don't want to make general statements. Okay, let's keep going. The sixth debate is root and secondary colors. That's on page 20. It begins with the challenger saying, it follows that if it's white, it's pervaded by being a root color. It follows that if it's white, it's pervaded by being a root color. Does something appear in your mind when you hear that statement? You have to stop and think, don't you? If it's white, it's pervaded by being a color. So which one is the bigger category, the bigger circle? Primary color, thank you. Primary color, so if it's a white color, it is pervaded by being a root color, is what's being said there. Okay, so I accept. In other words, it's saying white is necessarily a root color. That's another way of understanding that statement. So if it's white, it's pervaded by being a root color because... What's the reason? because white is one of the primary colors divisions. So then we're going to check, does the pervasion go both ways? It follows that if it's a root color, it is pervaded by being white. Can you see that? Does something appear to your mind right away? If it's a root color, it's pervaded by being white. So it follows that if it's a root color, it's not pervaded by being white. Well, pause it. In other words, give me an example that proves your point. For example, the subject, blue or yellow or red. That's right. So we've just gone through six debates. And I wonder, it's really your choice. We could pause here and do some practice with those six debates, putting in different examples, since we have so little time for practice. Or we could go on. We could look at shapes and sounds, and it's your choice. Let's go through them. Okay, so let's pause here for, say, 10 minutes and pick a partner and just go through. Pick a partner, go through the debate. You can do the same debate that's in the book. Does everybody have that on their device, or is anyone missing? Venerable Chinny has a hard copy. Tracy doesn't have it, so you pair up with someone who's got it on their computer, and then you can look at their computer. Okay, so we'll just pause here. And so the people at home, you can take time now to download the text if you don't have it, and just work through the debates, trying to understand them, and maybe you can fill in different examples. Are you starting to feel some possibility about we're actually going to learn debate, not just a bunch of definitions, but we actually learn how to work with the material? So you could actually start a debate by creating some context. Okay, we're talking about the selfless here. It's broken down into existence and non-existence, and then we're looking at existence, functioning things, and phenomena that are non-things, and then you can really hone in on the area that you're wanting to work on. And won't it be wonderful to have these basic debates just at our fingertips because we're so familiar with them? We don't have to look at the book eventually. That's the goal.
The reason why sometimes they say the reason is not established and no.
No is their definition or their translation for why, what we would say why. Chichir, does that mean why? It means you don't believe them. So in effect, it means no, that's not right.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know why they've translated it as no. I guess
can
that's very literal.
Can they be used interchangeably, like either response is
fine? If someone
fine?
Was saying no, would they say chichir? No. It actually means why, until you know what it means. So you'd have to use a lot more words like I don't believe you, or I have doubt about what you're saying, or something like that. So no just means mm-hmm. no, that's not right.
And could you use that interchangeably with the reason is not established?
In certain situations, and this is what
so
we'll
no.
have to learn, these yeah. certain situations in the debating context. You know, if we had a full syllogism, then you would only use reason not established when you're first checking is there a relationship between the subject and the reason. But it seems that if someone just gives a reason, because da-da-da-da-da, then you have carte blanche to say nonsense. Okay? Reason not established. That reason that you've just given is not established. There's no subject. There's no, you know, no subject of interest. So, yes, you can also say why. You can use either one. We have been predominantly using why because that makes sense to the English ear. Why? I don't believe that statement. Why do you say that statement? Give me a reason to believe what you've just said. Can you give me a reason for what you've just said? And then instead of giving a reason, the person throws a consequence. Oh, so it follows that that definition can be posited. So the debate could go in different ways, couldn't it? But we're just learning these stock debates so that we have the building blocks for going out and debating. Anything else? Any other questions come up?
We played a little bit of something else. It follows that if it's anger, it's pervaded by matter.
Matter.
Okay. Yeah. And then why?
Why?
And then it follows that if it's anger, it's not pervaded by matter. Let's, for example, take the microphone.
I accept.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Posit it. So the subject is anger. No.
The subject, resentment.
Yeah. Okay.
Or jealousy.
It follows that the subject, anger, is pervaded by being meta. I don't know. I like to apply that to something. No, because sometimes you, for example, you hit a person with a stick and you think the stick is the cause for your anger.
Oh, uh-huh.
So, and then to be able to think through it and to apply.
Okay. I would say keep playing with it until it becomes clear for you. And you can always look for...
Yeah, I hoped you could help me and make it for me right now. Right.
Maybe after class, nothing comes to mind. But when we're debating and you can always ask for a reason for clarification. If you're the challenger, you can ask for a reason for clarification. So anger is not matter because, and then you can say because it's not atomically established or because it's clear and knowing. You can give the definition of consciousness, which we're coming to in this next section of the text. So you could go either way. It's not, you know, it doesn't fulfill the definition of matter, or it fulfills the definition of consciousness. But I think you're asking something else, so we can keep talking about it. So let's just finish this section on colors and shapes. I think we can get through the rest of colors and shapes, and then we'll start with sounds next week. Yeah. So we might continue, and we might not. She may go further with the text. Okay, so how did the... Okay, so we're going to talk about shapes now. The definition of shape can't be posited. Oh, the definition of shape can be posited. It follows. Posit it.
That
just
suitable to be
a shape. That was... Oh, so it follows that the definition of shape is not that which is suitable to be shown as a shape. That which is suitable to be shown as a shape. At least that's how it's... You know, if you look at different translations, you'll probably find different... Maybe you saw it translated differently somewhere else. Okay, so we have the definition of shape. So how do the two compare, round bread and shape? Are you sure? Is a white horse white? This is exactly why we do these things, so that the comparisons stand out. So we're comparing round bread and shape. Bread, like the round bread that Venerable Jompa makes, the German bread. It's round, isn't it? Well, it's not complete. It's not spherical, but it is round. Mutually exclusive, right. Why are they mutually exclusive? Round bread and shape are mutually exclusive because, so I said, why are round bread and shape mutually exclusive? And you said, because round bread is principally an object of taste and shape is an object of visual form. Good. Very good. Okay, how do the two compare, round brown bread and color? Mutually exclusive. Why are round brown bread and color mutually exclusive, Venerable Tarpa?
I have to go with the last one, because color is not...
Okay, so Venerable Chinni, in the
because
last...
Because bread is an object of taste, and color bread is an object of sight.
Bread is primarily an object of taste, and color is an object of sight. It's a visual form. Yeah, so one is a taste or a taste source, and the other is a visual form or form source. Good. Okay. It doesn't? Form?
You see bread.
Well, the primary, okay.
It's a visual object.
Yes.
That's where I was
going to
say
asking.
That, and I'm like, it doesn't really work in my mind now.
I remember asking, what is the primary purpose of bread? It's to eat.
Yeah, I know. Okay. I don't.
I know. I've asked for a list. Please give me a list. What are the visual objects? What are the taste objects?
Yeah, I know. I know they have that. I don't subscribe to that theory.
Well, this is debate, and in debate, how I've heard it said before is that there's like a primary way of accessing an object, and then there are secondary ones. Like, for instance, you could touch bread. It's a tactile object as well, or tangible object.
Right.
You can smell bread for sure.
You can see bread.
You can see bread. So it actually is all of those objects, but primarily its purpose. When you look at its function, what is the function of bread? It's taste. It's to eat.
Yeah, see, it's so relative. Like, I used to make bread and deliver it, and it was a way I earned money. So its function for me was to earn money.
But people weren't buying bread.
buying it from you to put on your coffee table.
Right, I get that.
Or to sell it and make more money.
I get that, but it's just it's just so arbitrary.
Well, okay, I know it seems arbitrary, but if we really think about, we're talking about what are the primary, we're trying to know what is an object and how do we relate to those objects through our senses.
Right.
So what's the primary sense that engages bread?
Yeah, it just that really doesn't work for me.
Okay.
Because even when I eat, I would say it might be more the tactile sense. Because when I eat, I don't pay attention to taste, to tell you the truth.
Oh.
When I eat, I usually am just feeling my stomach, and it's a tactile thing. I don't pay much attention to taste. I don't have much sense of smell, so taste isn't so vivid for me. So what's vivid for me when I eat, generally, in fact, when we do the meditation, they say pay attention to the taste of things. I get so bored every time she has us do that. I can't even stand to do it.
Even with chocolate mint ice cream?
That's a, the exit. There are a few things. There are pretty few. Far between.
We know you, Venerable Tarpa.
Well, a point that Dan made in the book was that there are two perspectives on this. One, where you try and find the primary function, so bread would be taste. But the other one is where you mainly, it is that most things are objective, tactile, because of how we engage with them.
Let's see where that is.
Bottom of page 185.
185, and give us a starting word so that people who have the Kindle version can follow.
So how do Buddhists think of forms? So last paragraph.
Okay. So how do the Buddhists think of forms? Some Buddhist thinkers say that ordinary forms are classified as one of the five types of external matter on the basis of its predominant purpose or usage. Thus, a painting is a visible form. Bread is an object of the tongue consciousness or taste consciousness. Flesh and bones are earth and thus tangible objects, and so forth. Others say that pots, bread, flowers, and so forth are tangible objects because of being objects experienced by the body consciousness. Well, they're not exclusively experienced by the body consciousness. When you're eating, you've got body consciousness, taste consciousness, even smell consciousness to help you taste. Yeah, consciousness to get it into your mouth.
Decide if that's the bread you want.
Yeah. And like there might be some sound to chewing even. Okay. Indeed, the eye consciousness perceives the color and shape of a pot, but by this interpretation, the pot itself is earth and thus a tangible object. Seeing fire is a case of seeing the color and shape of fire, but the element fire, that which is hot and burning, is apprehended solely by the body consciousness. So, in a sense, I would agree with you. Oh, keep going. Okay, so that's the first perspective. The second perspective, thank you. The second position seems to be more defensible, he says.
He's given both perspectives.
Thus, the second position seems more defensible. You can imagine the endless quandaries that would result from trying to sort out the predominant purpose or usage of things. Also, the second position, that all these forms are amalgams of elements, is more in accordance with the scientific way of thinking, thus fits in for us. This issue is worthy of reflection, but harder to debate. So let's go back. How did the two compare, round, brown, bread, and shape?
Mutually exclusive. Bread has a shape and has a color, and bread's shape, round, would be three possibilities with shape, but bread is not a shape, and bread is not a color.
Right, so that's the same first way of looking at it. And if we looked at the second way, which is that bread is primarily a tangible object, right, then it's still mutually exclusive because a tangible object is mutually exclusive with shape, which is a visual object.
But with that line of reasoning, how could anything have a shape?
It has a shape. That's what I'm saying. It's shape. It has a shape, and its shape is three possibilities with shape.
You started off saying they're mutually exclusive.
Bread and shape are mutually exclusive. Bread is not a shape. It has a shape. The same as a horse is not a color. It has a color.
Yeah.
And so we can think of it in that same way.
Okay, so the subject.
The subject, round, brown, bread, and
shape
are mutually exclusive. Why? Because the subject, bread, is not a shape.
But if you said the round brown bread.
Yes, if you said the shape of the round brown bread, or the shape of the round bread, the round shape of the bread, either way, and shape, as you pointed out, it's three possibilities. The round shape of the bread
the
and
round shape of the bread, yeah.
Because the round shape of bread, in as well as the round shape of the gong, the round, or, you know, the beach ball, everything else. Okay, good. All right, so we won't be doing a lot of these kind of debates, will we? Christina?
So this reminds me of how we say aspects. We can perceive the aspect of something, but not the object itself. So, I mean, even the we say the pot is experienced by the body consciousness. You could also say the pot's tactile aspect is what's experienced by the body consciousness, not the pot itself. If we're going to say it's the color and shape that's experienced by the eye consciousness.
Yeah, usually we say it's said that object consciousnesses arise in the aspect of the object. Is that right? Did I get it backwards? The consciousness arises in the aspect of the object. So like a tactile consciousness is going to arise in the aspect of tangibility. The tangible, the body consciousness, there we go. Body consciousness arises in the aspect of rough or smooth, even, uneven, those sorts of things. High, low, did your bread rise or not?
Yeah, that's a very different way of stating than,
okay,
than here. So, but it's interesting because it shows the role of consciousness, that things are known through an experience, through the senses.
Sure.
So, like, what is the essence of the object? Well, it can only be known through these senses. But what is it? You know, it's, I don't know.
Okay, let's just do a couple more and then we'll finish. How do the two compare form and shape? Yeah, it's three possibilities. Why is that? Which is the larger? Which one pervades the other? Form pervades shape because form, when we're using form, it's a little tricky, isn't it? Form is synonymous or equivalent with matter. And shape is one aspect or one division of visual form, which is one instance of form. So we could, okay, so what's something that's both form and shape? Shape of a circle? Yep. And what is something that's form but not shape? Blue. What are some others? Just quickly. The microphone is a form but not shape. Yeah, that's right. And what's something that's a shape that's not form? Nothing. Form realm. No, just kidding. Okay, neither form nor shape? Consciousness? Some other ones? Sound is form, yeah. Person. Person is a... Yes. Yep. Right. Good. So then we can apply shapes to all the debates that we did today, can't we? Looking at the definition, the divisions, the examples, the pervasions. So that would be something that we can do in the meantime. Okay. All right. That's probably enough for one night. So either next week we'll look into sounds, etc., or Venerable Chodron will be back to take us further in the text. Okay, so let's rejoice that we've had the evening to increase our knowledge and actually get into some debating. We have some formulas now, some scripts that we can work with. All right, so we'll dedicate.